Some teachers will not go near a disturbed student until that soul is so sick of being in seclusion they voluntarily call for help. This can take quite a while, pause, then continues, other teachers drop in often for chats. Dr. N, eventually, will all these disturbed souls release themselves? S, pause, let's put it this way. Eventually, all will be released one way or another through different forms of encouragement, laughs, or persuasion. Those of you who are familiar with my work know that I have strong convictions about the influence soul memory has on human thought. The isolation and solitude of souls expressed in case 16 might well give one the impression of a Christian purgatory as a place of atonement. Could this religious concept have sprung from the fragmented soul memories of seclusion in the spirit world only to be subverted on earth? There are similarities and great differences between my findings about soul seclusion and purgatory as defined by the Church. Christian doctrine has purgatory as a state of self-purification for those who must eliminate all traces of sin before proceeding on to heaven. I hear that some souls in seclusion undergo self-cleansing while others may require energy restoration. However, we don't come out of seclusion totally purified or there would be no need to reincarnate again. Also, soul confinement is not banishment. In recent years, the less conservative elements of the Christian Church do not stress hell as much as in the past. Nevertheless, the Church still rejects universalism, the belief that everyone goes to heaven. To them, souls who die in a state of unrepentant mortal sin bypass purgatory and descend into hell where they suffer the punishments of eternal fire. To be eternally damned, according to the Church, is a separation from God, as opposed to those who are blessed. The Christian churches simply do not accept the concept that everything is forgivable in the afterlife. In my experience, all souls are repentant because they hold themselves accountable for their choices. From all I have learned, soul energy cannot be destroyed or made non-functional, but it can be reshaped and purified of earthly contamination. Souls who demand to be left in solitude after death on earth are not self-destructing, rather some feel isolation is necessary out of concern for contaminating other souls with negative energy. There are also souls who don't feel contaminated but they are not ready to be consoled by anyone. The important thing to keep in mind is that souls have the ownership of their energy and most ask their guides to be taken to the centers of healing and rejuvenation in the spirit world. These are therapeutic areas away from their soul groups where there is solitude and time for personal reflection. However, this is a form of directed therapy. The disturbed souls case 16 talked about had not yet chosen to receive help. All my case histories indicate to me that after death we have the right to refuse assistance from our spiritual masters for as long as we wish. I have been asked at lectures if the places of self-imposed exile are lower planes or lower worlds. I can't help but feel these ideas come from fear-based dogma. Perhaps it's a question of semantics. I think a better translation of this state is a self-imposed space, a vacuum of subjective reality designed by the soul who wants to be alone. Separated space, away from the soul's spiritual center, is one of its own making. I don't see these souls as being lost in some realm divided from the spirit world where others reside. The disjunction is mental. Souls of silence know they are immortal but they feel impotent. Consider what they do in solitude without help. They relive their acts over and over again, playing back all the karmic implications of what they have done to others and what has been done to them in their last life. They may have harmed others or been harmed by them. Quite often I hear they feel victimized by events over which they had little control. They are sad and mad at the same time. They have no interaction with their soul groups. These souls suffer from self-recrimination and restricted insight. One must admit these conditions fall within some of the definitions of purgatory. Sartre said, "We have an imaginary self of the world with tendencies and desires and a real self." To this statement I would add that of William Blake, perception of our true self may threaten mergence with that self. In their space, the souls of solitude had given up their imaginary self for a large dose of self-flagellation. Solitude and quiet self-analysis is an important and normal aspect of soul life within the spirit world. The difference here is that these disturbed souls are not yet ready to seek relief from their torment by asking for help, moving forward and making changes. It's a good thing that these souls make up only a small fraction of the population of souls crossing over each day. Discarnates who visit Earth. There are entities who travel to Earth as tourists and have never incarnated on our planet. Some are quite advanced while others are maladapts. The character of these beings has been described to me as friendly, helpful and peaceful, or distant, aggravating and even contentious. For thousands of years I believe they have been considered in our folklore as beings with the capacity to create both fear and enchantment. Our mythology alludes to the differences between light beings who are airy and whimsical and darker beings who are heavy with ugly temperaments. Some of these pre-Christian legends have spilled over into current religious beliefs of a light or dark tableau of grace or violence in the afterlife. Quite a number of my subjects have told me that between their lives on Earth they travel as discarnates to other worlds both in and out of our dimension. Some explain that they see other non-physical entities on these trips. This is why it has been surprising to me that only occasionally do I receive small amounts of information from clients about encountering other light beings on Earth. My clients see them when they decide to visit Earth as discarnates themselves between lives. The reports are intriguing, as the next case illustrates. Case 17. Dr. N, since you have described to me how much you enjoy traveling to both physical and mental worlds between your lives, I am curious what you know about other beings you might see when you come to Earth. S, they float through our reality here on Earth just as I do in other dimensions. Dr. N, do you know many souls who regularly incarnate on Earth that visit here like yourself? S. No, as a matter of fact, it's not all that common, but I like to come. Many of my friends enjoy a change in scenery between lives and stay away from Earth. When I come here, sometimes I see strange beings I don't know. Dr. N. What do they look like? S. Odd, strange shapes, wispy or dense. Not human looking. Dr. N, let's talk about this. You have told me of the ability souls have in the spirit world to project a human form. What do you and your friends look like as spirits on Earth? S, oh, rather the same, but on a dense world such as Earth, we shift more on the physical side, to add flavor to what we once were here. Dr. N, you mean you are in more of a corporeal state? S, sort of. On worlds such as Earth we are more defined around the edges, the way we outline a human body in a transparent fashion as soft, diffused light. In the spirit world when we assume body features, say of a former life, we glow all over with full strength energy. Dr. N, can a non-physical being, even in a diffused state, be visible to living inhabitants? S, chuckles, oh, yes. But only certain people can see us as apparitions and then not always. Dr. N, why is that? S, it has to do with their level of receptivity, of perception, at certain moments when we are in their area. Dr. N, if you will, please put yourself in the position of a transparent light being on Earth and tell me what you do here. I want you to include any non-human spirits you see who have had no incarnation experiences on our planet. S, happily, as visitors, we saw through the mountains and valleys, the cities and small towns. For us, there is a vicarious picking up of the energy of Earth's struggles. It's always interesting to bump into different kinds of beings who are also on tour here. They know Earth's inhabitants are afraid of us and most of these beings would like to dispel the fear, yet, those of us from Earth know we can't afford to get entangled with people's lives in any major way. Dr. N, meaning that some beings from other worlds have no such reservations? S, yes. Dr. N, I assume by entangled you mean interfering in someone's karmic path. S, well. Yes. Dr. N, but why not help people if you can? S, abruptly, and maybe with some guilt, look, we are not guides assigned to Earth. We are only visitors, as are the others we see here occasionally. It's a vacation trip for all of us. If we come across a condition going bad, we might take a moment to briefly turn ahead toward a better alternative path. We do get pleasure out of nudging people to act in their better interest rather than turning the wrong way. Dr. N, if you happen to be in the right place at the right time, S, right, to give a gentle push in a better direction at a crucial moment, raises voice, no fixing of major trouble spots, you understand. Dr. N, then you would be considered as good as spirites. S, laughs, as opposed to what? Dr. N, in an attempt to draw this subject out, to bad spirits who interfere with life forms for the pleasure of doing harm. S, abruptly, who told you this? There are no evil spirits, only inept ones, and those who are careless and indifferent. Dr. N, how about sad spirits, or ones who are disoriented, or playful spirits? Can't they cause harm? S, oh, yes, but it is not premeditated evil. Pause, and then adds, not all of us are in the same category, soaring around Earth on a lark. Dr. N, that's what I was getting at. I'm thinking of ghosts. S, these are spirits grounded here by their own volition. Dr. N, how about the spirits who are strangers to Earth? S, pause, there are other spirits who travel interdimensionally who we consider to be maladapts. They do not seem to have any sensitivity to Earth. They are not knowledgeable about human beings. Dr. N, coaxing, and can they cause problems for the living? S, edgy, yes, sometimes, although it might be unintentional. They are not bad or evil, just clumsy, mischievous children. The younger light beings can get lost between and within dimensions. Their amusements distract them. We consider them as naughty youngsters. These pranksters think Earth is their playground where they can engage in devilish behavior with susceptible, gullible people and scare the hell out of them. They have a hilarious time before they are caught by one of the rovers, tracker guides, sent to recapture these truants. Dr. N, is this a common occurrence? S, actually, I don't think so. They are like children who escape from the watchful eyes of parents once in a while. Dr. N, so you don't see malevolent spirits directed here by some demonic force? S, promptly, no. Sometimes we might run into a dark, heavy entity who is disoriented by the Earth's fear. This place is dense, but they come from places even more dense. Anyway, they want to cling to us because they don't know what they are doing. We call them the heavies because of their lack of mobility. Dr. N, what about the spirits you spoke of who are just indifferent to people on Earth? S, deep sigh, yeah, they can scare people. This is because some of them have a disruptive nature. They are not considerate. Dr. N, bulls in a china shop. S, yeah, no adaptation to local customs. Dr. N, and, in these cases with different types of spirits who might be aggravating to the people here, do you try to intervene in some way? S, yes, if we come across them acting like rogues, we put a stop to it and try and push them away. This is very infrequent. Most out-of-worlders are serious and respectful. Pause, I want to stress that we are not philanthropists. This is our recreation time and we want to be free of responsibility. Dr. N, okay then, why would an inept spirit of any sort come to Earth for whatever reason and be allowed to cause trouble, even inadvertently, for the people living here? Do their guides lack good parenting skills? S, unruffled, well, too much monitoring makes for dull children. If they were on a tight leash, how would they learn? They are not going to be allowed to destroy or do great harm. Dr. N, one last question. Do you think that all the kinds of spirits we have been talking about exist in large numbers swarming all over Earth? S, not at all. Compared to Earth's population, only a tiny fraction. Judging by my own experience here, there are times when only a few are around and I may not see them at all. It is not a constant thing, it's more cyclic. There is a mystery to that which is invisible to the living, when only our senses tell us something is there. I wonder if spiritual travelers don't engender memories within us of recognition of what we once were and will be again. Demons or devas, I think it is fitting that I close this chapter with a summary of some misconceptions we have about the existence of evil spirits, good spirits and spiritual influences on Earth. If I step rather heavily on any pet theories of the reader, please understand that my statements come from the reports of many hypnosis subjects in my practice. These subjects do not see the devil or demonic spirits floating around Earth. What they do feel when they are spirits is an abundance of negative human energy exuding the intense emotions of anger, hate and fear. These disruptive thought patterns are attracted to the consciousness of other negative thinkers who collect and disseminate even more disharmony. All this dark energy in the air works to the detriment of positive wisdom on Earth. The ancients thought demons were flying beings who occupied the regions between heaven and earth and were not particularly wicked. The early Christian church elevated demons to the status of evil rulers of darkness. As fallen angels, they were able to disguise themselves as messengers of God rather than Satan in order to deceive humans. I think it is fair to say that within the more liberal religious communities today, demons represent our own inner misguided passions that can get us into trouble. In all my years of working with souls, never once have I had a subject who was possessed by another spirit, unfriendly or otherwise. When I made this statement at one lecture, a man raised his hand and said, "That is all very well, O great guru, but until you have placed everyone in the world under hypnosis, don't tell me about the absence of demonic forces." Of course, this is a valid argument against my hypothesis that such things as soul possession, evil demons, the devil and hell don't exist. Nevertheless, I can come to no other conclusion when all of my subjects, even those who came to me with conscious beliefs in demonic forces, reject the existence of such beings when they see themselves as spirits. Once in a while a client comes to me convinced they have been possessed by an alien entity or some sort of malevolent spirit. I have had other clients who believe an evil curse has been placed upon them from some past life behavior. As my hypnosis regression session moves into the superconscious mind of these people, typically we find one of three conditions. 1. Almost always the fear proves to be absolutely groundless. 2. Occasionally, a friendly spirit, often a dead relative, has been trying to reach them. My distraught client has misinterpreted the intent of this spirit who only wished to bring comfort and love. There has been miscommunication between the sender and receiver. Souls have little trouble with telepathy between themselves, but this does not mean all souls are adept communicators with incarnated people. 3. Very rarely, a disturbed, inept spirit has made contact because of some unresolved karmic issues they have on Earth. We saw this in case 14. Researchers into the paranormal have come up with three more reasons which ought to be added to my own as to why certain people believe they have been possessed by a demon. 4. Emotional and physical abuse as a child, which create feelings that the adult abuser represents an evil power who has total control. 5. Multiple personality disorder. 6. Periodic increases in the actions of electromagnetic fields around Earth which are sufficient enough to disrupt brain activity in a disturbed individual. The possibility that people can be possessed by a satanic being comes right out of medieval belief systems. It is fear-based and the result of theological superstition that has ruined countless lives over the last 1,000 years. Much of this nonsense has dissipated in the last 200 years, but it lingers with the fundamentalists. The exorcism of demons is still practiced by some religious groups. Frequently, I find that clients who come to me with concerns about possession have lives which seem to be out of their control and filled with a variety of personal obsessions and compulsions. People who hear voices commanding them to do bad things are likely to be schizophrenic. They are not possessed. Our physical world may have unhappy or mischievous spirits floating round, but they do not lock in and inhabit the minds of people. The spirit world is much too ordered to allow for such muddled soul activity. Being possessed by another being would not only abrogate our life contract but destroy free will. These factors form the foundation of reincarnation and cannot be compromised. The idea that satanic entities exist as outside forces to confuse and subvert people is a myth perpetuated by those who seek to control the minds of others for their own ends. Evil exists internally, initiated within the confines of the deranged human mind. Life can be cruel, but it is of our making here on this planet. Assuming that we are born evil, or that some external force has occupied the mind of an evil person, makes malevolence easier for some people to accept. It is a way of rationalizing premeditated cruelty, preserving our humanity, and absolving ourselves of responsibility individually and collectively as a race. When we see cases of serial killers, or those of children who kill other children, we might label these people as either born killers or under outside demonic influences. This saves us the trouble of finding out why these murderers enjoy inflicting pain by acting out their own pain. There are no soul monsters. People are not born evil. Rather, they are corrupted by the society in which they live, where practicing evil satisfies the cravings of depraved personalities. This emanates from the human brain. Studies of the psychopath have shown that the excitement of inflicting pain on others without remorse satisfies an emptiness they feel within themselves. Practicing evil is a source of power, strength, and control for inadequate people. Hate takes away the reality of a hateful life. The warped minds of these executioners tell them, "If life is not worth living for me, why not take it away from somebody else?" Evil is not genetic, although if a family has a history of violence and cruelty to their children, these acts are often passed on from one generation to the next as learned behavior. Violence and dysfunctional behavior from one adult member of a family is an internal emotional reaction that spills over to contaminate other younger members. This can lead to compulsive and destructive behavior from children of that family. How do these genetic and environmental disruptions to the body affect our soul? What I have found in my practice is that a soul's energy force may, during troubled times, dissociate from the body. There are those who feel they don't even belong to their bodies. If conditions are severe enough, these souls are prone to thoughts of suicide, but usually not taking the life of another. One will have more to say about this condition in upcoming chapters. Part of this turmoil stems from conflicts between the soul's immortal character meshed to the temperament of a host brain with all its genetic baggage. There may also be influences of abnormal brain chemistry and hormonal imbalances affecting the central nervous system that might contaminate the soul. Another element I find is that immature souls often have difficulties handling the poor mental circuitry of disturbed human beings. There is a counteraction of the soul self versus the human self. A push and pull ego force is struggling to present a single ego to the world and not doing very well in the process. These are internal, not external forces at work. A disturbed mind does not need an exorcist but a competent mental health therapist. Souls don't represent all that is pure and good about a body, or they wouldn't be incarnating for personal development. Souls come to Earth to work on their own shortcomings. In terms of self-discovery, a soul may choose to act in conjunction with, or in opposition to, its own character in the selection of a human body. As an example, a soul combating tendencies towards selfishness and indulgence might not mix well with a human ego whose emotional temperament is disposed to engaging in hostile acts for self-gratification. Quite often, troubled people have suffered painful environmental trauma such as physical and emotional abuse as children. They have either internalized themselves, creating a shelter hide behind their pain, or externalized by mentally moving outside their bodies on a regular basis. These defense mechanisms are a means of survival to preserve our sanity. When a client tells me that they love to tune out and practice astral projection because the out-of-body experience makes them feel more alive, I look for disturbances. Indeed, I may not find anything other than curiosity, but an obsession with being away from the body indicates a desire to escape from current reality. It is perhaps for this reason I am troubled by the walk-in theory as another escape mechanism. I believe the whole idea of walk-ins to be a false concept. According to the proponents of this theory, tens of thousands of souls now on this planet came directly into their physical body without going through the normal process of birth and childhood. We are told that these possessing souls are enlightened beings who are permitted to take over the adult body of a soul who wants to check out early because life has become too difficult. Therefore, the walk-in soul is actually performing a humanitarian act, according to devotees of this theory. I call this possession by permission. If this theory is true, then I must turn in my great guru white robe and gold medallion. Not once, in all my years of working with subjects in regression, have I ever had a walk-in soul. Also, these people have never heard of any other soul in the spirit world associated with such practices. In fact, they deny the existence of this act because it would abrogate a soul's life contract. To give another soul permission to come in and take over your karmic life plan defeats the whole purpose of your coming to Earth in the first place. It is deluded reasoning to assume that the walk-in would wish to complete their own karmic cycle in a body originally selected and assigned to someone else. If I am a senior in a high school trigonometry class, would I leave my class and go down the hall to a freshman algebra class where a student is struggling with an exam and tell him I'll finish the exam for him so he can leave early? This is a loose-a-loose situation for both students, and what teacher would permit it? The whole walk-in theory is like suicide, although it is supposed to combat suicide by allowing the walkout soul to escape responsibility for straightening out their life. The walkout soul relinquishes ownership of its host body so a more advanced spirit who does not want to go to all the trouble of being in a child's body can take over. This is one of the major flaws of possession by permission. From everything I have learned about body assignments, it takes years for a soul to fully meld its energy vibrations with that of a host brain. The process begins when the baby is in a fetal state. All the essential elements of who we really are come from the soul assigned to a specific body from the beginning. Consider first the three is emanating from the soul: imagination, intuition and insight. Then add such components as conscience and creativity. Do you think the adult human mind is not going to recognize the loss of its partner self to a new presence? Now, that would drive a host body insane as opposed to healing it. I tell people not to worry about losing their soul. It's with us for the duration because there are good reasons for having the particular body you occupy. Souls take their responsibility very seriously, even to the extent of being inside non-functional bodies. They are not materially trapped. For instance, a soul may inhabit a comatose host body for many years and not abandon it until death. These souls are able to roam freely across the land visiting other souls who might be making brief trips away from their bodies during normal sleep states. This is especially true of souls in the bodies of babies. Souls are very respectful of their host body assignments, even if they are bored. They leave a small portion of their energy so they can return quickly if needed. Their wavelengths are like homing beacons who have fingerprinted their human partners. When a soul's energy does leave the human body, this does not provide an opportunity for some demonic being to rapidly move in and occupy a vacant mind. This is another superstition. Aside from the non-existence of such demonic beings in the first place, the mind is never completely vacant of a traveling soul's energy. A malevolent entity would be unable to squeeze in, even if it did exist. Evidently, residents of the spirit world are quite aware of our enthrallment with dark and nefarious specters who pose a danger to the soul. I have a most unusual and defining case which brought this to my attention. The ironic engagement of demonology employed in case 18 by my subject's teacher toward his hapless student is outrageous and unconventional but effective. This case illustrates how the almost brutal use of humor can be graphically applied in the spirit world to define our shortcomings on Earth. Case 18 concerns the death experience of an evangelical preacher of the 1920s. This man had spent a lifetime seeing the devil in every nook and cranny of his town in the Deep South. During my review of this life with the client who carried these memories, I was told, My parishioners were shaken to their bones with my fiery sermons of the hell awaiting all sinful transgressors. I will begin this case with a scene as it unfolded right after my subject reaches the gateway. Case 18. Dr. N, you say that although things are not too clear, you are floating in bright light and someone is coming toward you?